Advanced Studio Classroom is on the air. Medical care is becoming more objective rather than subjective. Hello, listeners. Welcome to Advanced Studio Classroom. This is Bill Quinn, and today is November 5th, 2013. Thanks for joining us here. We're on day two of our business article, The Big Data Revolution. You can find it on pages 14 through 16 in your Advanced magazine. And we learned yesterday about how some new computer programs are actually helping medical centers crunch just mountains of data, and actually what this is leading to is a better understanding of all sorts of things, from running operations more efficiently in a business-like manner to actually helping put together DNA codes to help people recover and actually prevent death from cancer. So there's a lot of applications that can be used for this, and it's very important for all of us. It will impact all of us, whether now or in the future. I've got my two panelists back here today, Joanna Wirtz and Campbell Chong. Hi, panelists.
Hello.
Good to have you back for day two here. And before we get into our reading for today, let me get a thought from each one of you, just a review point from yesterday. So first, our Baylor University graduate, Joanna Wirtz.
What's up?
Yes.
Intrigued. This article is intriguing. It's very interesting. Intriguing is a good word to remember. I hear it fairly often, and it's just a cool way to say, that's interesting.
Did anybody ever say, you're intriguing?
Yes, every day. Sometimes twice a day.
Often at the 7-Eleven, men come up to me and say, I'm intriguing. Yes?
Yes. That's how they say it.
You're intriguing. Now, as far as I mentioned, you are a Baylor graduate. Why did I say that? Why did I even mention that to our listeners?
Because in the first day, we talk about Baylor Healthcare System, which has been involved firsthand in processing some of this big data.
And it's actually quite well known, the Baylor University School of Medicine and School of Nursing also. So Joanna was very familiar with these places down there since you went to school there, and you've moved on. But it has quite an impact all throughout the state of Texas, even all throughout the United States.
It's well known, yes.
Yeah. All right. Campbell Chong.
Hey. I thought it was really interesting how this big data really is revolutionizing the healthcare industry, and how it said yesterday, how we read that the healthcare industry used to be data rich but information poor. So they had a lot of statistics. They knew a lot about, okay, you know, certain number of patients had certain number of things happening to them, but they didn't know how to process all of this information. And now with big data, it's changing things. And now whether a medical organization would succeed or fails, it's very objective, as you were saying earlier. You know, it's something that is very cut and dry now. It's not based on feeling.
I just, this whole article is making me think back to when I was, maybe when I was a child or a teenager, and just going to the doctor, like if I was sick or just for some small procedure. It was, compared to this, it just seems so informal and unofficial, because you would go see the doctor, and most of the stuff, the doctor would be carrying a clipboard around and writing things down with a pen or a pencil on a chart, and nothing was being keyed into anything, and it was all just handwritten stuff, and a lot of times the doctor would just, you know, take your temperature, take your heartbeat, you know, feel your head or your stomach or something. You just kind of make a judgment call, it seemed like. It was very subjective, and it's all changing.
Right.
Yeah. And now it's where every piece of information, it seems like, is being entered into a computer somewhere. Everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's all being tracked. Mm-hmm. So there's good points and bad points to that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, and as we read yesterday as well, they're doing even more ambitious medical research. They're able to handle even more information and study more people at the same time.
Okay. Let's go to our reading for today. It is on page 15. And if you're wondering why we're spending so much time in the great state of Texas, this article does come to us via the Dallas Morning News. So that's why we've got several medical centers all throughout the state of Texas. And we visit another one there in Dallas in the first part of our reading today.
Methodist Health System in the Dallas area is analyzing accountable care organization claims from 14,000 Medicare beneficiaries and 6,000 employees to predict who among them is most likely to need high-cost care in the future. "We are really just beginning to unlock the potential of analytics," said Melissa Gerdes, Chief Medical Officer of Outpatient Services and Accountable Care Organization Strategy at Methodist.
Methodist Health System. This is another large medical system there in Dallas. Yesterday we had talked about the Children's Medical Center, Dallas, and the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center venture. This is a different one we're talking about here today, Methodist Health System. And what are they doing, Campbell?
Well, they're analyzing claims from 14,000 Medicare beneficiaries and 6,000 employees to predict who among them is most likely to need high-cost care in the future. And I'm assuming the reason they're doing this is because this information will affect how much these people pay for insurance.
Now, what do we mean by the term accountable care?
Well, when we talk about an accountable care organization, we're talking about a group of professionals who provide medical care, and they come together and people can choose amongst these professionals, this group of professionals, and they can decide who they want to service them.
All right, and they're looking at claims from 14,000 Medicare beneficiaries.
Beneficiaries are people who receive a benefit, money, something. They're just receiving something.
Okay, they're receiving money. And they, actually, this is money from the government. Medicare is a health-providing system that is through the U.S. government. And usually it involves people that are retired, people that are on Social Security. Medicare is part of that benefit for retirees. And then also they're taking a look at 6,000, the information of 6,000 employees. To do what?
Well, to predict who among them is most likely to need high-cost care in the future, what we were talking about earlier. Maybe the insurance records that exist already with these people will say this person has X condition and will likely need this expensive treatment in the future to treat it.
Way back in the beginning of our article there yesterday in the first column, second paragraph on line 10, we said predictive program that we were talking about. And actually, that is what we're talking about here as far as plugging in this data from 6,000 employees and trying to predict who among them will need health care in the future, right?
Right. I mean, here we're talking about 20,000 people, right, with the 14,000 beneficiaries and the 6,000 employees. 20,000 people here to process data for. And so that's a lot of people. And now with this new program, they can do it more efficiently.
This actually enters into one of those areas where a lot of people have a problem with some of this stuff. Because one of the issues that has come up as we've discovered more about DNA and our genetics and then tying in this stuff as far as analyzing all of the data from people, then we might get into too much of predicting who's going to have healthcare problems.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of medical ethicists say this could be an issue because employers might look at somebody's health profile and see a predictive or a prediction chart of that person, and they might be interviewing two people for a job. I might be interviewing Campbell and Joanna for the same job, but somehow I'm able to get information, and it's very possible in the future I might have access to that.
Right.
And I might look – both of you are perfectly healthy, qualified, same education, you know, levels, great people. But then I can look and I see something on Joanna's chart. It's like, oh, 8 years from now, it's likely she might be suffering from some disease.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing there today.
Right.
But we get into this predictive nature of things, and actually I would say, well, Campbell, we're going to hire you.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even explain to Joanna why I'm not even going to hire her.
Right.
And this also impacts so many other things.
Right.
How insurance companies have set insurance rates.
Mm-hmm.
You may be perfectly healthy, but they say, well, it's likely you're going to get cancer 12 years from now.
Right.
Or 20 years from now.
Yeah.
So there's a danger with some of this.
Yeah. And I mean, in my experience with the medical profession, you know, I admire doctors and nurses and what they do, and I'm very appreciative. But I also have learned that, you know, they're human. They're not mm-hmm. able to predict the future. And a lot of times I think the danger is to take the doctor's words as truth and mm-hmm. as fact. But what they say may not necessarily happen.
Yeah. Okay. All right. We move into this next paragraph, and we hear from Melissa Gerdes.
Well, Melissa says, we are really just beginning to unlock the potential of analytics. Analytics being the field of data analysis used to research and analyze potential trends in order to gain information.
Okay. She's the Chief Medical Officer of Outpatient Services and Accountable Care Organization Strategy at Methodist Health System, and she actually needs two business cards to fit that title on.
Yeah.
All right, that's a long title. Let's get into our next reading for today.
Improving efficiency. What is big data? The term can mean different things to different people. In their recent book of that title, Victor Mayer-Schonberger and Kenneth Kukier say that because of the improvements in high-performance digital technologies, researchers can use literally all the data available in their areas of interest, rather than relying on smaller sample sets. More trumps less, they write. As more and more data go into machine learning algorithms, performance improves dramatically. A typical Excel spreadsheet can contain up to about 1 million rows and 16,000 columns of information. In a big data analysis, Gilder said, data potentially could fill millions of rows and billions of columns. A regular desktop computer would churn 3 days and then flash the blue screen of death, Gilder said. He then nodded at the Dell. With this thing, it may run 2 days, but you get an answer.
Okay, improving efficiency. What is big data?
All right, so we've been talking about big data for the better part of today and all of yesterday. So big data, we finally get an answer here, and it says that the term can mean different things to different people.
Okay, now we move into a book that was written.
Yes, that book's written by Victor Mayer-Schonberger and Kenneth Kukier, and they say that because of the improvements in high-performance digital technologies, researchers can use all of the data available instead of just whatever small part they're able to process.
Okay, now Victor Mayer-Schonberger is actually very well known. He's like the leader in this field of processing large amounts of data. He's actually a professor at Oxford University in England. And Kenneth Kukier is actually the data editor for The Economist magazine. So they did a lot of research on this book. They've actually produced a lot of other works concerning big data. And they're able to use these formulas in a lot of different fields. I had mentioned not just medical, but for instance, they're studying economics. For instance, studying the economies of Europe and trying to impact policy there. And also, big data can be used to understand, for instance, global warming, because there's so much data that goes into that. Those are some of the other fields that this can be applied to. Now, of course, we're talking about the medical field here. But they say the researchers can use this data in areas of interest rather than just relying on smaller sample sets.
Right. It says that you can literally use all the data available. I think in the past, because computers weren't able to handle that much information, they had to choose a smaller sample set, just a small amount of that, all the data they had. But now they don't have to choose. They can use all of the information they have and get more accurate results.
All right. Now, what do they write?
They say more trumps less. More is more important than less.
Okay. And they continue here. This paragraph continues with as more.
That's right. As more and more data goes into machine learning algorithms, performance improves dramatically. So as I said earlier, the more information they have inside these computers, the more that's processed, the more accurate information comes out.
All right. Many people might be familiar with Excel spreadsheets on their computers. They might use them at work to make charts or maybe track some information. And we get some surprising information on what a typical Excel spreadsheet can contain.
Well, you might not use Excel spreadsheets to the fullest capacity, but it says that an Excel spreadsheet can contain about 1 million rows and 16,000 columns of information. That is a lot.
Did you know that?
I didn't. I don't really know Excel well. I've not had to put in that much information.
No, I didn't know that, and I'm not sure why I would need that much information. But in fact, that's just one example. We might be familiar with Excel, but it can grow even larger, right?
Right, but now that's just a typical example. In big data analysis, data could potentially fill millions of rows and billions of columns.
Okay. And so there's a lot more information that can be handled with this big data, with the systems that can handle it. And in fact, now here's an example we can all maybe kind of relate to.
Right. Gilder. Again, Richard Gilder is a biostatistician at Baylor Healthcare System. He says a regular desktop computer would churn 3 days and then flash the blue screen of death.
Now, what do you mean by that?
Well, the blue screen of death is something that happens to computers. You know, there's a fatal error on your computer and the whole screen just turns to blue and it just has an error message.
It just gets overloaded.
Yes.
Yeah, and it stops functioning. Yeah, and there's only so much and then it just stops. It will shut down. So this, what he's saying is most computers would just be overwhelmed by all of this data. However,
this new $20,000 Dell computer that they have, it can run 2 days, but you get an answer. It's not going to crash.
Yeah, but it's, you know what's surprising is it 2 days is a pretty long time.
It is.
You know, I mean, you would have to be really patient, I guess.
Reminds me of rendering video.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, so you're processing billions and billions of columns of information. Mm-hmm. So.
This is such a change, though, because most of us sit at our computers and we key something in and we're like sitting there. And if something takes 10 seconds, we're starting to lose it.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure one day this is going to take no more than a few seconds.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So, well, fortunately, Richard Gilder does have this a new customized Dell computer, and then also he has the Clementine system in his software that can handle all of this information. Okay, let's move on to our third reading for today.
Gilder and his boss, Donald Kennerly, the Associate Chief Quality Officer for Baylor's Institute for Healthcare Research and Improvement, describe their data lab as a think tank where what-if questions can be asked in a group environment that promotes more questions. What do we need to work on next month that we didn't know we needed to work on? Kennerly said as he gave a tour of the lab. With a large table and a big screen for remote video conferencing, the lab allows data experts and clinical experts, nurses, doctors, surgeons, to review materials together. Each participant brings an important perspective.
Bill Quinn here with Campbell Chong and Joanna Wirtz, and we're talking about the big data revolution. We're on page 15, and our third reading today starts at the top of the right column, and we're going back to Baylor Healthcare System, and Richard Gilder is a biostatistician there, and talking about how they process all of the data there, and Richard Gilder, and then we're also meeting his boss, Donald Kennerly.
That's right. Donald Kennerly, his job is the Associate Chief Quality Officer for Baylor's Institute for Healthcare Research and Improvement. Another long title there. So they describe their data lab as a think tank where what-if questions can be asked in a group environment that promotes more questions.
Think tank.
A think tank is an organization whose work is to study specific problems and suggest solutions. It's pretty much problem solvers.
Mm-hmm. A lot of times, too, think tanks will exist to try and influence policy. We have a lot of think tanks located around, for instance, Washington, D.C., and they will be oriented regarding specific issues. And they try to analyze things and come up with policies mm-hmm. on things.
So. Actually, on an interesting note, our former editor of Advance, Naomi, is now working at a think tank in Canada.
Yeah. Okay. I'm sure she's doing plenty of thinking.
That's right.
And she might be thinking about what-if questions.
Right. What-if questions are just questions that start with what if. Well, what if this happened and what if that happened?
What's the purpose of that?
It's to get you thinking and, you know, it helps you to start coming up, helps you to think of some solutions.
Yeah. A lot of times businesses and organizations will do that, gather people together in a group environment and, hey, let's just all sit around and the purpose of this meeting to ask what if. And it just actually is to get people to generate some new ideas.
Right. I think it talks a little bit about that in the next paragraph. It says, what do we need to work on next month that we didn't know we needed to work on? So it helps you to start thinking, well, what are some potential things that we need to start tackling?
Let me ask you, both of you work together on Let's Talk in English mm-hmm. as far as the magazine. Do you guys ever do this or something similar to that?
We do. We try.
Yeah? Hey, you've got what if questions, but also, do you ever have situations where you realize there's stuff you have to work on this month you didn't even realize last month?
Yes, that comes up sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think often we're trying to think of, you know, the best way that we can share this information or the best way that we can teach English. So mm-hmm. we try to think of different scenarios that might come up.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So it's good. It's good just to ask questions. Sometimes that's really all you need to do to get a conversation started to make situations better. Just start asking questions. What if we did this? What if we did that? What if we tried this?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times it's just a matter of getting the conversation started to then generate new ideas. So that's what Richard Gilder and his boss, Donald Kennerly, are talking about. So now he was giving the writer a tour of the lab there at Baylor. And then we move on to a large table and a big screen. And what was that for, Joanna?
Well, it's for remote video conferencing. So people in the lab can talk with people, perhaps experts in the fields outside of the lab. They can all plug into this video conferencing and have a meeting together, even though geographically they may be located very far away.
Well, I think it's a great idea. You know, in the past, we always had people get on planes and everybody would fly to one city. It was really expensive and time-consuming. And now it's so much easier. They can just do video conferencing in so many cases and just save everybody a lot of time and money. So we bring all these people together here at Baylor, nurses, doctors, surgeons, to review the materials together. And what's great about this?
Well, it says each participant brings an important perspective. It just means that each person looks at the data in a different way and they share their opinions.
Okay. All right. Hey, we mentioned earlier in the program that Naomi is off working at a think tank. Well, we still hear from her every once in a while. Now she's going to tell us how to contact us and let us know if you have any questions about this article or any other article and how you can join the discussion at our website.
Hello, everybody, and thanks for listening to Advanced. If you have any questions about today's program or any previous program, just go to our website, www.studioclassroom.com, and you have a couple of options available. First, you can join a discussion with other Advanced listeners by going to the English Corner. It's a great way to meet some other members of our audience, leave comments, and give us your ideas for the show. If you want to write a note to the Advanced team or have a question, just go to letters@studioclassroom.com and we'll do our best to help out. We always look forward to hearing from you, our listeners and readers, and we appreciate your input.
Yeah, be sure and do that. If you've got questions or you want to join the conversation, go to our website, because I know that several of our teachers, we check the conversations periodically on all three of our magazines, and we love to hear from you. And if you do have a really difficult question, we'll try and answer it, try and give you a good response on that. So now, I mentioned earlier how big data can be used in different fields. We were talking about this book, Big Data, by Victor Meyer Schoenberger and Kenneth Kukier, make that. And last year, we actually had an article on Coursera and online studying, and it was really interesting. We talked about a student in Greece who was taking an online course, and actually he was using big data to actually analyze the debt problem in Greece and what might be the best possible solution as far as interest rates and bank policies. So that is an example of how data like that can be used to impact society. What other areas can you think of?
Well, I think it could probably be used in advertising. You can see, you know, the success of maybe some advertising campaigns and to see whether or not the money that they're putting in is being effective with the marketing.
Yeah.
You could also use big data in education by analyzing maybe certain data sets of different types of students, different types of educational techniques, public school versus private school versus charter schools, homeschooling, different economic sectors. The possibilities are endless.
Right, and come up with what might be the best method for teaching students, or come up with a set of methods that can be applied to different groups of students.
That's right.
Instead of just taking one thing and applying it to everybody.
Right.
All right. Listeners, thanks for being here for day two of the Big Data Revolution. Come on back for day three tomorrow. We'll see you then. Goodbye.
Bye. Goodbye.